In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, which stimulants are safe to take at night, maximizing the benefits of cold thermogenesis, when to do blood flow restriction training, and much more.
Health, performance, nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Well, Jay, I had to floss my teeth this morning before our podcast.
Oh man, yeah. What did you have to floss your teeth for? That's an uppity scale thing around these waters to do that type of thing.
Sure. Well, I mean, you guys got pretty big gaps in your teeth down there in the Southeast. So, anyways, I have to be careful, by the way, of insulting rednecks in the Southeast. I might get people with
pickup trucks and
gun racks showing up at my door. You have to drive a long ways up to Washington State, and then you'd have to find me. I had jerky for breakfast, and I've got this new recipe. I've been making liver jerky. Have you heard of this?
No, I mean, I have not heard of it. Actually, no, I've heard of it, not tried it.
How could you not have heard of it? It's famous by now. It's my famous liver jerky. No, I actually have been making both heart and liver jerky. It's kind of a cool way to get all the nutrient benefits of organ meats. You know, the heart has a lot of CoQ10, and the liver has all your fat-soluble vitamins and some choline and, you know, other good nutrients in it. So what I did, and I do this with a lot of my organ meats, I soak it in kefir. You know, a lot of cookbooks tell you to soak your organ meats in buttermilk or lemon juice or even salt water. But kefir turns out to be really, really great for breaking down and like drawing out a lot of kind of the gamey flavor. It's got these really good enzymes in it. And so I make kefir every week anyways, because sometimes I'll use it as a base for smoothies. You know, often I'll use bone broth, but sometimes kefir. So I always got a batch in the fridge. And it's super simple. It's kind of like making, you know, sauerkraut or, you know, pickles or, you know, any other ferment, and these kefir grains just kind of grow almost like a sourdough starter. So, you know, you just feed them every week with milk and you get a new batch every week. And I found that with my kefir, if I put a little colostrum in there and a little bit of prebiotic fiber, it gets super creamy, because the prebiotic fibers kind of feed the bacteria and the colostrum seems to lend some creaminess to it as well. So anyways, though, I soaked the liver in that for about a day, like a good 24-hour soak. And then I found this really, really kind of cool trick that makes it just taste absolutely amazing before I put it in the food dehydrator, right? So you cut it into your jerky size pieces after you've soaked it in the kefir. You know, doing it afterwards, it just cuts easier. And then what I do, you know, after I rinse the kefir off and it's all chopped up and in my preferred jerky size, is I sprinkle a bunch of salt on it before I put it on the dehydrator. But this last batch, what I did was I put all the little liver pieces into, you know, just like a stainless steel bowl, and I coated it with, and I wish they were a sponsor for today's show, because they're going to get a shout out. I coated it with the Organifi red juice. You know, it's got like pomegranate and cranberry and beets. And my thought process was, you know, this could kind of like almost give like a caramelized type of texture to the jerky. And, you know, it's a little bit sweet and it's got an interesting flavor profile. So I did that. So, you know, it's all coated with this red juice and sea salt. It's like a red juice powder, I should clarify. And then I just did the 12-hour, you know, jerky dehydration. I think the setting's like 155 degrees. Anyways, oh my gosh, this jerky is so good. Like nice. With this red juice powder and sea salt on it, with that pre-kefir soak, you know, I just finished writing a cookbook that's off of the publisher right now. And I wrote to the publisher, I'm like, can I add this to the cookbook? This is amazing. And they're like, nope, sorry, already filled up. But anyway,
so a website for it.
So yeah, there's a little jerky recipe for those of you, Martha Stewarts, who are out there listening in and want to don the apron and chop up some liver, baby.
Yeah, so a couple of things. You say, so Ben Greenfield says that when you perform kind of this routine of dehydrating this liver and heart, that it doesn't have a gamey taste. But to somebody who has not either partaken in liver or heart, do you think that that individual would say the same thing, or do you think they would still find it pretty gamey?
I think they find it pretty good, because I had a dinner party at my house the other night, and there were three people who had never had organ meats, and I gave them all a piece of this jerky, and they loved it. They said it tastes like candy. Nice. So yeah.
Interesting. So does it actually like taste?
I mean,
like
they were drunk, but you know, they thought it tasted pretty good.
The only caveat. Yeah. Cool. So, nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's jump into today's news flashes.
Let's do it.
I want to start with something kind of sad. Ireland's Supreme Court has ruled that bread sold by the fast food chain Subway contains so much sugar that it cannot legally be defined as bread.
Bummer. Now we can't go there anymore.
Yeah. I mean, we've all known. I was explaining this to somebody I was doing a consultation with last night, and they couldn't lose weight, and they were having whole grain bread with breakfast, whole grain bread with lunch, like a sandwich with lunch and a, you know, some toast with breakfast. And I was explaining to them that bread can spike your blood sugar higher than like a Snickers bar. Because a Snickers bar has, like, you know, some peanuts and some fats, a little bit of protein in it. But bread is notoriously high in terms of the glycemic index. It turns out that the sugar content of Subway sandwiches, bread is about 10% of the weight of the flour. And to be classified as bread, it's not supposed to be any higher than 2%. So that was one blow against Subway that makes, and I'm assuming it's the same in the U.S. as it is in Ireland. I didn't do a ton of research, but at least kind of raised my eyebrow, because I'm always kind of, you know, paying attention to some of the stuff about food. But then a Canadian study, you know, which is closer to us than Ireland, so it must be legit. They found that the Subway chicken is only about 50% actual meat. You know, I'm not trying to take down Subway or anything, but I just want people to know, you know, because a lot of people still think Subway is healthy. So it's about 50% meat, and the rest is all in terms of the DNA that they tested in the meat. They used a forensics DNA laboratory. All of the rest of it was just soy.
Wow.
Which is a little bit concerning, because Subway actually claims that its chicken strips and oven roasted chicken contains 1% or less of soy protein, but they actually did a forensics analysis, which, and I think they use the same type of lab that can, you know, figure out who murdered somebody. So it must be, again,
this
legit.
Must be accurate.
So yeah, I mean, you know, the food babe. All remember the food babe when she's the health blogger who criticized Subway's bread for containing, it was like azoto dicarbonamide, that which is the ingredient found in yoga mats. And she was like, "Oh, you're eating yoga mats." I don't. Technically, when you consume that, the body breaks it down into water, so it's actually not as big of a deal as it sounds like. But this is a big deal. I mean, you're chomping down on fake meat and bread that's not even actually bread because it's so high in sugar when you're eating at Subway. So just, you know, proceed with caution, my friends.
Jeez. Yeah. So, yeah, there are a couple of things here. Number one, I would actually, I mean, I don't know this. I mean, you say that there's probably, you know, this is probably the same thing here in the U.S., but my guess is that it could be even higher in sugar content here in the U.S. just because everybody here in the U.S. has a freaking sweet tooth. So they might be like, oh, damn, we need more sugar in this bread. And the other thing is, man, I used to eat Subway when I was in college, like probably two or three times a week, because, you know, I thought it was healthy.
Yeah.
And the chicken was the thing that I always got.
Oh, yeah.
But it was always grotesque. Like, I never liked eating it. And so, I mean, I haven't been to Subway in probably a decade.
Yeah.
And so I don't plan on going back.
Yeah. Well, I switched to Subway from, I used to go to McDonald's for 4 years in college for lunch every day. And I did the Big Mac. I got the extra, the secret sauce, Giant's Dr. Pepper, and then the supersized fries. That was my lunch, like, every day in college. And then I started taking all these nutrition classes and kind of learned a little bit about vegetable oils and, you know, sugars. And I switched to Subway because I thought it was healthy. And I ate Subway for about 3 years. And I actually really liked a lot of, like, their, what they had, like, the meatball sandwich. I think that was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I still do walk by a Subway, kind of like when I walk by a Cinnabon at the airport, and I still do salivate a little bit, I got to admit. Like, I still think it smells pretty bomb. But
then you remember you'll get man tits if you eat that chicken.
Yeah, yeah. So anyways, though, shifting focus from man tits and Subway, this was kind of cool because I love cold water swimming. I always have since I was a triathlete. Like, that was one of my favorite parts, was just like having a nice, chilly, invigorating cold water swim, even though My skinny ass often needed, you know, like a wetsuit, even a thin wetsuit to be able to survive for that long. But at Cambridge University, they studied a bunch of cold water swimmers. And it was very interesting because doctors have known for a long time that cooling people down can protect their brains. Dr. Jack Cruz, for example, who's a neurosurgeon, who's kind of well known in the alternative health community and the biohacking community, is a guy who does some of his brain operations and uses cold thermogenesis, like ice packing around the head, and even has his patients do a lot of like cold therapy leading into and after a surgery. And the reason for this is that what happens is you get the production of these cold shock proteins, and the cold shock proteins, those can actually be relatively protective to the brain and have even been known to be associated with staving off things like Alzheimer's and dementia. And at Cambridge, one of the things that they did was they cooled mice. And then they also cooled mice with Alzheimer's disease and prion disease, which is a neurodegenerative disease of the brain, to the point where the mice became like a little bit hypothermic, which actually people get hypothermic when they do this kind of like intense cold water swimming, you know, like the folks, you know, who you know, meet every week on the bay in San Francisco and do the cold water swims out there, which I tried. I lasted like 10 minutes. Again, it's about as long as my skinny ass could go. But then what they found was when they rewarmed the mice, the ordinary mice could regenerate their synapses, and the Alzheimer's and the prion mice could not. And they found levels of a cold shock protein called RBM3 really went up very quickly in the ordinary mice, but not in the mice with Alzheimer's and neurodegenerative disease. And what they showed was if they artificially boosted the RBM3 levels in the mice with the Alzheimer's and the prion disease, they were actually able to stave off dementia and Alzheimer's. And so they were doing this because they're trying to develop a drug that prompts the production of RBM3, because we know, you know, only like 1% of the population who has dementia or Alzheimer's or is concerned about brain degeneration is actually going to get in an ice bath or go do cold water swims, because they do kind of suck, you know, to a certain extent for a lot of people, even though I think they get you get like this rush of endorphins, and it gets kind of like a sauna. You almost get addicted to a little bit of cold here and there after a while.
Oh, yeah.
But they also tested a whole bunch of cold water swimmers. During the winter, I think that was like the past four winters, they tested RBM3 levels in these winter and cold water swimmers at a club in London, and they found they all had these really high levels of RBM3. And it turns out that essentially what this comes down to is that cold water swimming and the production of these cold shock proteins, which arguably you could also get through things like cold showers and cold water immersion, they stave off the progression of dementia and Alzheimer's and may even decrease your risk of actually developing that, even if you have a genetic propensity towards it, due to the production of these cold shock proteins. It's also interesting because, you know, in the Finnish study, they found the same thing with saunas. So, I mean, you know, once again, it turns out that probably one of the best things you can do for your body is like sauna a few times a week and cold water swim a few times a week, or just cold water soak or something like that.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, I've had to grow to love this. I mean, it's something that when I first started it, I hated it. And still for like the first like 15 seconds, I might hate it even still after a few years of doing this. But like from a neuro, like cognitive, neuroprotective type factor, like this is like my number one thing. It is like such an easy, free hack for my overall kind of neurocognitive effects. Yeah. And so I love it.
Yeah, and we know, you know, related to the man tits that you brought up earlier. I don't know, is it offensive for us to say man tits?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see in the comments.
Cancel culture, you never know. Like I'm sure we're offending somebody. Anyways, though,
we're men, we have tits. I mean,
yeah, we do. So we know that in the case of something like cold thermogenesis, you get an increase of the conversion of metabolically inactive white adipose tissue into metabolically active brown fat. It's based off this thing called mitochondrial uncoupling protein. And this uncoupling protein generates heat. You know, it burns calories to generate heat. And brown fat is very high in this uncoupling protein. Well, another study that recently came out showed that ketosis or ketones can significantly increase that conversion. And so even though this has never been actually studied, if we know that the consumption of ketones or the presence of ketosis, whether it's nutritional ketosis or in this case, they were actually consuming in rodent models the ketone beta hydroxybutyrate, which is what you get in a lot of supplements, that ketone salts or ketone esters, significant increase in the activation of this uncoupling protein and the conversion of white to brown fat. And so what this means theoretically is if you wanted to kind of enhance the effects of something like a morning cold thermogenesis session, not only should you do it fasted, you know, but you could also like take a dose of these ketone esters or ketone salts prior and increase the effects of the white to brown adipose tissue conversion or the activation of this uncoupling protein. And that's really interesting because we did a podcast. Do you remember that podcast a while back where I reported on a study that looked at all the different food ingredients that could enhance white to brown adipose tissue conversion?
Yeah, yeah, I definitely remember that one.
Yeah, they were capsaicin was one, like red pepper. Resveratrol was another. Curcumin was one. Green tea, omega-3 fatty acids from fish, and then like a topical menthol, you know, like those topical cooling ointments. And all of those can enhance the effects of cold thermogenesis. And so, you know, maybe this is an idea for my supplements company, Keon, or any other business-minded person out there, but why not develop like a pre cold thermogenesis product that's like, you know, red pepper, resveratrol, curcumin, green tea, and omega-3 fatty acids along with some ketone esters. And you could like consume that prior to doing like a cold bath or a cold soak or a cold shower or a cold water swim and enhance the fat loss effects even more. That's my bright idea.
Dude, I'm game. I will definitely partake. Well, you get the fat loss effects and also too the cognitive boosting effects from both of them. So, I mean, it's a win-win all the way around. So count me in.
Yeah. You know, it wouldn't be that hard, honestly. You know, everybody's got a little bit of red pepper in their pantry. Resveratrol is an easy supplement to get. Curcumin is an easy supplement to get. Green tea is simple to find. Any menthol topical lotion is simple to find. We are right now in the process of launching an amazing fish oil at Keon. And so once you put all that together, it'd be pretty easy to just like, you know, stock your pantry and have your little section, you know, even if nobody, you know, was able to formulate a supplement that was kind of like done for you and just, you know, have your little stack that you take pre-cold. So anyways, if anybody out there experiments with it, go to the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/420 and let us know if you try that out. If you notice anything, if you do things like track your body composition, you know, on a regular basis or something like that, I'd be curious. But it's kind of a cool idea. So there you have it.
That is a cool idea. You know what else is cool is that you just mentioned that this is Q&A 420. So all of our stoners are ready to go.
Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. I get laughed at maybe because it's a little bit woo-woo, esoteric, invisible, whatever. But I use Quantum Energy. I pray over my food when I eat. I try and emanate positive emotions and feelings towards people. I do like little breath work and Tibetan longevity exercise moves to charge up my body with invisible energy. And yes, I even blast my home and my body with certain quantum energy products like necklaces and little boxes that I can use to charge up food. And I get this all from this company called Lila Q. Now, I realize that some quantum energy stuff is not provable by science, but Lila does have third-party studies revealing a remarkable 20 to 30% increase in ATP production, a vital process for cells. Quantum Energy has over 59 studies already done and counting. These are randomized double-blind studies these folks are doing for blood quality and HRV optimization. I can't explain it, okay? I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I can explain how quantum energy would increase blood energy or blood quality.
could be placebo. I don't know. But all I can tell you is I wear their necklace. I use their products. I blast my home with their energy. And it's called Lila Q. I've got a podcast with them, a few, if you want to take a deeper dive. But you just go to the website. Check it out. It's kind of fun to surf around. And you know what? If anything, you're going to have some cool-looking conversation products at your house and hanging around your neck. I love them. Lila Q, LEELAQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. LeelaQ.com. Use code BEN10 for 10% off. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order.
So, I think, you know, we used to, on all of our announcements, we had all these places I was going to speak and people would come see me speak and, you know, and all these conferences and expos, none are happening. So our special announcement section is pretty simple to get through, really, folks, because the world has slowed down. Anyways, bengreenfieldfitness.com/420. We'll also put all those discount codes, all the news flashes, and we'll also include robust show notes for everything you're about to learn about in today's listener Q&A.
I've listened to a lot of your talks on using blood flow restriction bands, which I purchased when gyms were closed to use for kettlebell training and bodyweight work. Now that gyms are reopened, I'm back to training heavier weight with barbells, dumbbells, and cable machines. Do you see any benefit to incorporating BFR with hard sets of strength training inside of a gym, or not so much?
Oh, BFR training. It is kind of uncomfortable. The burn with BFR training is distractingly uncomfortable. But I mean, I just got back from Sedona, where I had like a 4-day getaway with Angelo, the CEO of Keon. You know, we were just planning out some stuff, like our amazing fish oil. And I just traveled my BFR band. And I also like to bring some of those X3 bar resistance training bands. And, you know, I do just like body weight resistance training. And that's generally like kind of like the convenience factor of using these, you know, tourniquets or occlusion devices to cut off a little bit of blood flow to muscles and allow you to essentially trick your muscles into thinking they're lifting a heavy weight, even though you're just training with, say, body weight only or with some light resistance bands. And, you know, we could go deep into the science, but in the show notes, I'll include links to some pretty significant, like, KAATSU and BFR training episodes that we've done. But, I mean, in a nutshell, you get an activation of these things called myogenic stem cells, which are responsible for the repair of damaged muscles and the growth of muscle fibers. Those increase just as much as they do with heavy resistance training when you do BFR. You get a significant increase in growth hormone and an insulin-like growth factor to increase collagen synthesis post-exercise, and a downregulation in myostatin, which inhibits cell growth. And so when you downregulate that, you get more muscle hypertrophy. You get hypoxia because you're cutting off a lot of the blood delivery to the muscles. That hypoxic environment causes a surge in lactic acid, which once you take the bands off, you get this big release of what's called hypoxia-inducible factor, which can grow new blood vessels. It increases like BDNF and vascular endothelial growth factor for the brain. So you get like this, you know, rush in mental energy. And then you also get a little bit of cell swelling, you know, like this anabolic reaction of cell swelling, not only due to the activation of those myogenic stem cells, but also the blood pooling from the blood rushing back in. And so if you are one of those people who just likes to have, you know, say, fellas, you like to have your arms popping for a date night or something, like this is the perfect workout to do on that day that you're going to wear your favorite t-shirt or go to the beach. And so there's a lot of benefits of BFR training, but the question is, specifically to here, like, is it worth doing in conjunction with just like regular weight training? Like, could you somehow get an advantage with doing it with barbells or dumbbells or cable machines? And it turns out they actually have researched this. And what they've found when they've combined these blood flow restriction bands with resistance exercise, which is something I used to do back in the day when I was bodybuilding, I would tourniquet my arms and legs, usually for about one workout every couple weeks or so, and just do my normal workout with the arms tourniqueted. And I would always get this amazing response for a few days. It was like I was just more swole. I didn't know about any of this.
And you were lifting as heavy as you would without
the
bands.
Yeah, I was just doing my normal weight training routine, but with the bands on. Now, what they've found when they've actually looked into this is that if you do resistance exercise with the bands on versus without the bands, you actually do see a greater release of growth hormone, a greater release of testosterone, more of the benefits that I've just described. And the tricky part, though, is everything is way more difficult to lift. So you're probably going to be able to do fewer reps, that's one reason that people who do BFR training, they're often trained more frequently, because you're actually damaging the muscles less, but getting a lot of the same results without the muscle damage. However, you can exercise a little bit more frequently because you're typically doing fewer reps and sometimes using less weight when you're doing this blood flow restriction training. But it turns out the studies that have compared like doing your high intensity training or weight training with BFR versus without BFR, with the BFR, you actually do see, even if you're not able to do as many repetitions or even use as much weight, increases similar to the gains that you would get without the BFR.
That's interesting. I did not expect you to say that, actually.
Yeah, there's definitely something to it. Now, a lot of people get concerned about thrombosis, like the formation of a blood clot due to the obstruction of blood flow. But, you know, that there's no research that low intensity BFR increases the type of coagulation that would cause that breakdown of or the increase in the production of clots. As a matter of fact, the research on it shows it may increase due to more what's called fibrinolytic activity, the breakdown of clots. So we know that's perfectly safe. Lifting super heavy with a lot of occlusion, though, there's no studies I could find that looked at risk of increased coagulation or blood clot formation in that scenario. So I can't say I've seen any research that indicates that you're going to increase your risk of a clot by lifting heavy with BFR training. I can tell you, though, bodybuilders do it all the time. And you don't see bodybuilders dropping dead left and right of blood clots while they're doing BFR training. I haven't even seen a single case study or anecdotal study where that's occurred, or anecdotal incident where that's occurred. So I'm not that concerned about it. I mean, proceed at your own risk and make sure that you're not putting them on too tight. And ideally, you know, if you can afford it, you get one of these CATSU training devices that lets you very precisely dial in the millimeters of mercury that you would use to kind of stay in your safe range, which would, you know, definitely for a heavy weight training session, probably not be anything above like 300 millimeters mercury of pressure. But ultimately, you can see greater benefits by doing your normal weight training routine with BFR bands on or CATSU bands, even if you're not able to do as many reps, which you probably won't be able to do. So,
yeah. Would you recommend, Ben, you know, let's say for this listener, if they're, let's say they're lifting four times a week, like, do you think they should limit it to like once or twice a week, or you think they'd be fine with doing it four times a week?
You could just be, it'd suck. It's painful.
Yeah. Like,
it's just a lot of burn. I mean, if you're a glutton for punishment. Yeah. I mean, the way I use BFR training is, honestly, you know, I only use it with body weight or with resistance bands when I'm traveling. And part of it too is, you know, you do get some restriction of movement that may impair your mobility, your biomechanics, your form, especially if you're doing things like, you know, squats, cleans, some more complex barbell exercises, multi-joint exercises. You just might not be able to maintain quite as good a form when you got lactic acid, you know, pouring out your eyeballs. So that's something to think about too. Yeah, it's kind of the same concept as like wearing those elevation training masks when you're training. Yeah, you're gonna strengthen your inspiratory and expiratory muscles and increase your CO2 tolerance and everything like that. But you can kind of impair biomechanics just because you're so gassed. So kind of that same concept. So
right.
Anyways, though.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, you do get a crazy good pump from it, but yeah, I'm like you. Yeah. Only use it if I'm doing body weights or like sandbags or some functional fitness. Yeah. I've never used them actually in the gym while you know doing bench or doing squats or deadlifts, but yeah. Might give it a try this week.
Yeah. All right. So there you have it.
Hey Ben, I recently had surgery for neck cancer and need to do 6 weeks of radiation. I was just wondering your thoughts on the top three things to do to reduce side effects. Love the show.
Oh man. Well, my heart goes out to Jim, and Jim, will keep you in our, mm-hmm. in our thoughts and prayers there with the surgery for neck cancer and the radiation. Cause I know it just kind of sucks when you're undergoing, you know, radiation therapy. And that is a form of ionizing radiation. Kind of depends on the type of radiation that's used. You know, external beam radiation is generally delivered outside the body, but then there's like internal beam radiation where you're actually placing radioactive materials inside the body, which arguably would be a scenario in which, you know, the consumption of certain nutrients and compounds, et cetera, to limit some of the damage could be a good idea. And there is, of course, evidence that external beam radiation therapy, based on the same concepts as, you know, the type of damaging ionizing radiation you might get from Wi-Fi routers, cell phones, et cetera, can do a little bit of damage to cell membranes or increase calcium influx into a cell or even do a little bit of DNA damage. And so, you know, arguably, even though I'm not a doctor and I don't want this to be misconstrued as medical advice, a lot of the same things that have been studied for any form of ionizing radiation, including cell phones, Wi-Fi, et cetera, could extend to be applied to staving off some of the potential damage from therapeutic radiology. So, and technically, when you're placing radioactive material inside your body, that's a type of radiation therapy that's very commonly used to treat cancer. It's called brachytherapy, you know, when it's internal radiation. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit more problematic than the external radiation, because again, it's going straight into your actual body tissue, you know, radioactive materials. But, you know, if I were actually undergoing radiation therapy, whether it was internal or external, there are certain things that I would do. And this actually has been, it's been studied. There's a very interesting paper that was published back in 2007 in which they investigated the radioprotective potential of plants and herbs against the effects of ionizing radiation. You know, and this is something anybody who does get exposed to EMFs, Wi-Fi, radiation therapy, you know, travels a lot through airports, et cetera, on a regular basis should actually sit up and take notice of. Because, you know, the general concept here is that some plants and herbs do have radioprotective potential. And that's very, very similar to the idea of the xenohormetic effect, meaning that the polyphenols can scavenge radiation-induced free radicals due to an elevation of cellular antioxidants by these plants and herbs. You know, they have mildly toxic compounds in them that, of course, have been roughly vilified by the carnivore community and that we actually covered in our last podcast. If you guys want to take a listen to podcast 419, we kind of talk about which of these are problematic and which are not, you know, like lectins, you know, gluten, you know, phytic acids, et cetera, and even polyphenols. But these polyphenols upregulate mRNAs of antioxidant enzymes like catalase and glutathione transferase and glutathione peroxidase and superoxide dismutase. And so they can counteract a lot of the oxidative stress induced by ionizing radiation. I would argue the benefits of that occurring would exceed any cons in terms of like mild, you know, like a little bit of gut damage, for example, you know, like Stephen Gundry talks about in his book, Plant Paradox, or, you know, potentially a little bit of the toxicity from some of the built-in protective mechanisms of these plants. I think that the response in terms of cellular antioxidant production, especially in the face of ionizing radiation, dictates that, you know, I think the pros outweigh the cons of the consumption of the type of plant and herbs that have been shown to have some radioprotective potential. Specifically, the ones that they looked at in this study that were most notable, even though they used a lot of kind of like the botanical names, so it's tough to know exactly what they are. You know, when you look at like Mentha piperita, right? We know that's going to be a form of black pepper, but it's not like you're going to type in Mentha piperita on Amazon and find what you want. But if you do some research on some of these, you know, it's not going to be that hard. I'll link to the paper in the show notes. But a few of the biggies, a few of the most significant were Panax ginseng, which is commonly known, pretty easy to get your hands on. Ginkgo biloba, mm-hmm. Ginkgo biloba was another. Black pepper was one. Curcumin extract, you know, like turmeric, curcumin, things like that. And then ginger. Ginger was a biggie as well. And I'll link to the full paper because there's actually over a dozen different nutrients that they looked at in the study. And there was actually another paper in 2011, and that happened after the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster in Japan, in which they looked at resveratrol, and they found that resveratrol, you know, like grape skin extract, could actually protect against radiation injuries as well. So you could throw that in there along with your ginger, your ginseng, your ginkgo biloba, black pepper, turmeric, and some of the compounds that are in this study that I'll link to in the show notes. Also, in 2013, in the Journal of the Advanced Practices of Oncology, they looked at some complementary strategies for the management of radiation therapy. And in that study, they found aloe vera, glutamine, deglycerinated licorice extract, and then they actually identified quite a few in there, probiotics, psyllium, manuka honey, a calendula, melatonin, and even acupuncture, all to have some effect at limiting the damages of ionizing radiation. Now, I realize that I'm listing off a lot of things, but for those of you who want to dig into the papers, who are concerned about the effects of ionizing radiation, kind of want to put together your own stack, so to speak, what I'll do is if you go to the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/420, I'll link to a lot of these papers. Now, I would say, and this is my own strategy, which I developed after interviewing Dr. Joe Mercola and digging into his book, EMF'd. You know, we talked about the three basic mechanisms of action via which ionizing radiation can damage cells and mitochondria. It was basically direct DNA damage via radiation, this steep influx of calcium into the cell, and then the upregulation of oxidative stress due to the activation of your body's inflammatory pathway called the NRF2 pathway. And what I did after interviewing him was every time I travel now, I use a higher amount of NAD along with sirtuin. In my case, I'll just use, I think that something called, like an alternative to resveratrol. It is, why am I blanking on the name of it? It's the one that starts with a P and it's up in my pantry. But it's not pantry. It's, you know, I'm talking about tarostilbene. So I take that because I think it's better than resveratrol as far as the sirtuin goes, but I pair that with NAD and that's for the DNA damage. And then I use magnesium to offset the calcium influx. And then I just use ketones to downregulate the NRF2 pathway. Cause I don't have the time to put 20 things into my suitcase when I travel, but I just use the NAD with the tarostilbene, the magnesium and the ketones. And that's what I use when I'm like going through airports, flying. I actually, if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/5G package, I just made like an Amazon list of those three things that I use to kind of protect myself from some of the damaging effects of ionizing radiation. But that's my approach. Although a lot of other things, like I mentioned from those other studies, have been looked into, but I'm just kind of a creature who likes simplicity. So I use NAD and sirtuins, magnesium and ketones. A couple of these studies looked into a lot that goes beyond that, like the ginger, the ginkgo biloba, the ginseng, the curcumin, etc. But I think that armed with the results of those couple of studies, and then that list I made at bengreenfieldfitness.com/5G package, you should be able to get your hands on a decent amount of things for natural protection. I don't think you got to use all of them, but you know, just choose maybe 3 to 5 different ones to throw into the mix. And that's where I'd start.
Hi, Ben. This is Caitlin from Canada. And I have a question. I have recently started chewing the Lucy nicotine gum. I'm not a smoker. I've never smoked before. I'm loving it and loving how it makes my brain feel. But I've noticed on my Aura ring that my readiness score has been dropping, and it's been about a month, and usually I get between 90 and 93 daily for my readiness, and it's now significantly dropped to like 75 to 82. I don't eat late. I eat by like 6 p.m., rarely have a drink, and I'm usually in bed by 9 p.m., so I feel like I'm doing everything right, and I can't figure out what that change might be besides the nicotine, and I'm just wondering if nicotine could have any effects on overall recovery. Thank you.
Do you chew that Lucy nicotine gum?
Jay. I do. I don't do it as much as I used to, but I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Some company is developing a new form that's flavored with it's flavored with monk fruit. They sent me a couple of their trial products. It's pretty good. It's some keto company. I probably shouldn't say right now, but they're developing this nicotine gum that's got is just monk fruit and nicotine. And it's really good. It's like a 4 milligram dose of nicotine.
What does Lucy use? Do they use stevia or do they use something?
They use all sorts of different stuff, but they use lower amounts of some of the artificial sweeteners than a lot of these other companies. And you know, that's generally, if I'm going to chew nicotine gum, usually I'll do that Lucy stuff. Or I also like John Lawrence's Zen spray, which is like the Amazonian hape. That's more of like a nasal spray that does have some nicotine in it as well. And I like it because unlike coffee, it has a pretty short half-life. Nicotine does, meaning it's not gonna stain your system. You know, it's got a half-life of a couple of hours. You know, it gets metabolized in the liver to cotinine it's called a cotinine. And then cotinine will stay in your system a little bit longer, but doesn't seem to like disrupt sleep or activate the sympathetic nervous system quite as much as nicotine. And so because of that, like I can chew a piece of nicotine gum before like a dinner that I want to be a little bit more wakeful during, and maybe I'm tired at the end of the day, and it doesn't, you know, wake me up quite as much as a cup of coffee or keep me awake, you know, quite as long as a cup of coffee might. But it is a stimulant, and they've actually looked into this. There's a few interesting studies that have looked into the effects of nicotine specifically on activation of the sympathetic nervous system, or specifically like reducing HRV. One study found that a single dose of 4 milligrams produces a significant reduction in your heart rate variability due to its increase in what would be called the low frequency score. And so, you know, because of that, it could definitely affect your aura ring readiness score. There was another one where they actually looked at rabbits, and they found a similar thing, like a nicotine induced catecholamine released that also decreased HRV. Now, interestingly, there was one study that found that nicotine actually did not lower HRV, and I don't know why, but in this case they combined it with black tea. I'm not quite sure why they combined nicotine and black tea. Maybe it's because a little bit of the caffeine in the black tea, or maybe they're trying to see what some of the polyphenols would do. But in this case, they used less nicotine. They used about 2 milligrams, and they didn't find that it had as big of an impact on HRV. So there's definitely a dose response effect, you know, and you'd probably want to, if you're using it at night, especially go with as low a nicotine dose as you're able to use, you know, like closer to 2 milligrams, for example, or, you know, cut a 4 milligram piece in half or something like that. But yeah, so the Aura Ring readiness score that Caitlin is referring to, what the Aura Ring does, and that's generally the wearable that I prefer, just because I don't like wearing something on my wrist. I wear like a cheap ass $15 Timex watch and then just my Aura Ring. But it takes resting heart rate, it takes heart rate variability, right? The amount of time in between your heartbeats, your body temperature, and your respiratory rate. It takes those four variables, and then it feeds that into an algorithm and kicks you out a readiness score. I believe it also takes into account, in addition to the body temp, the heart rate, the HRV, and the respiratory rate, I think it also takes into account your sleep balance and how much you've exercised. I'm pretty sure.
Yep, sleep.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah. Okay, good. If you're consuming nicotine and noticing that it drops your readiness score, then theoretically it's probably doing so due to the slight increase in resting heart rate. Probably the decrease in HRV, it does impact sleep parameters a little bit. Like it can disrupt deep sleep if you take it at night.
Yep.
And so, you know, it's one of those things where, I mean, the short answer is yes. I mean, like it is a stimulant. It's less of a problematic stimulant at night compared to, say, like caffeine, for example, or yerba mate or something like that. But it definitely is going to nicotine decreases your heart rate variability and will decrease your readiness score due to not only the decrease in heart rate variability, but the increase in resting heart rate and the drop in sleep. And so you just have to ask yourself whether the surge in energy or the increased alertness that you might be looking for is worth that trade-off.
Yeah, I'd say for Caitlin, just run a simple experiment. I mean, just try it with it and try it without it and see what happens to the readiness score. Consideration, body temperature, resting heart rate, you know, HRV, respiration rate, and sleep. And so, yeah, it's likely affecting some area. So kind of just open up the data and analyze it a little bit. And then from a heart rate variability standpoint perspective, and this would kind of really qualify for everything we just mentioned, is that when you are taking in any caffeine, but more specifically when you're taking in nicotine, this is a vasoconstrictor. This is also going to kickstart the sympathetic nervous system. And so because of that, therefore, you're going to see drops in HRV. The heart is going to start regulating itself because basically nicotine is going to be a signaler to the heart that, hey, you took this or this was ingested for a means. Like you have reason to take this. And the reason for you to take this is to get up and get going, whether it's cognitive or it's physical performance, whatever it may be. And so you're just bound to see this. If I take nicotine, like actually for me, interestingly enough, Ben, if I have nicotine later in the afternoon or I would say evening time, I have a very similar response actually from a readiness perspective in my Oura Ring than when I drink alcohol. Yeah. It almost looks exactly the same. I might have a little bit lower HRV with alcohol, but for the most part, it will drop my readiness. So for me, I kind of cut it off past like one or two, but I just really am sensitive to nicotine.
Yeah, the vasoconstrictive effect is something too that I actually have had a couple of guys who start on nicotine. It might depend on your nitric oxide pathways too. Like if you have, you know, what Dr. Ben Lynch, the author of the book Dirty Genes, would call like a dirty nitric oxide pathway where you have trouble producing nitric oxide anyways. Or was it the last podcast where we took a deep dive into nitric oxide? I think it was.
It was either the last one or the one before.
Yeah, it was podcast 418 or 419. If you check that, we geeked out on all the things that can decrease your ability to produce nitric oxide, like mouthwash, fluoridated toothpaste, you know, a host of factors. And, you know, if you already have impaired nitric oxide function or impaired nitric oxide production, it can also contribute to almost like an erectile dysfunction type of scenario if you throw nicotine in the mix along with that. So I have nothing against nicotine, you know, and of course we know it's mildly addictive as well, which is a wonderful business model for a company like Lucy Gum. Ultimately, yeah, I mean, you do need to be aware of some of the potential trade-offs. So, you know, this kind of ties into the next question. So let's play this question from Steve.
Hey, Ben, this is Steve. I recently started taking night classes for my graduate degree, and the classes are typically from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., which is really late. And I was wondering if you had any tips for maintaining mental acuity, making sure that I'm nice and sharp for those classes without keeping me up too late afterwards. Because things like caffeine are great, but they do tend to disrupt my sleep. And I want to get to sleep as soon as possible after those classes. So any advice you have would be great. Thanks.
All right. Well, as we were just talking about, nicotine could be one option due to its, its shorter half-life compared to something like caffeine, which I think caffeine's a half-life of what, 15 hours, 12 hours, something like that.
And Was it that long?
It depends whether you're a slow or a fast coffee oxidizer, but it definitely will impair sleep at night more than nicotine because it's going to stay in your system for a longer period of time, even if you're a fast coffee oxidizer. I mean, in most cases, coffee afternoon, whether you're a slow or a fast oxidizer, will disrupt sleep, period. Yeah, it's just it just happens. So there, you know, when I have to stay awake at night because I'm traveling outside my normal time zone, going to like late night dinners or parties or meetings, you know, which again happens when I travel, or you know, even if I'm going to go whatever, you know, see a fight in Vegas or something like that, you know, there are times when I'm definitely out past my bedtime, but I know I still want to go to sleep. Like I don't want to, you know, take 100 micrograms of LSD and be up till 5 a.m. or, you know, drink a cup of coffee and sleep, but not really get my deep sleep cycles. And so there are certain things that I use at night. One I already mentioned, and it would be due to the short half-life. I will use nicotine at night. Like before a dinner party, I'll pop some gum and chew it while I'm driving to the dinner party. All right. So that's one thing that I've found when I take, it still decreases my readiness score and decreases my HRV a little bit, but I can at least sleep. You know, if I, if I can take nicotine as late as like 8 p.m. and still, you know, go to bed at 10:30 and be fine. Another one that's similar that I already mentioned due to the presence of small amounts of nicotine is that Zen nasal spray from Dr. John Laurent's, which is a blend of oxytocin, which is kind of nice if you're out in a social setting anyways. It's great for a date, for a social setting, for an evening activity. But it's blended with a little bit of this Amazonian hape extract, which is really great for clearing the head. It's got trace amounts of nicotine in it. And it's actually a little bit of a vagal nerve stimulant. And so I think that because of that, there might be a trade-off in terms of the potential impairment of HRV. The cool thing is, and I don't know if John and I talked about this on the show, was he has one version that's got the Amazonian hape in it, but then he has another version that's just peppermint and rosemary, and I think it's, I believe it's cinnamon essential oil, and a little bit of oxytocin. And so that doesn't even have any nicotine, but it's essentially like you're huffing peppermint and rosemary up your nose, which are all, you know, wonderful natural essential oil stimulants. And I'll do that at night a lot, you know, because I have both his Zen spray that's made of the hape, and then I also have his Zen spray that's made of just the regular essential oils. And the one with the essential oils at night doesn't disrupt sleep a bit. It's literally just like smelling peppermint. Mm-hmm. And so
sounds spicy.
Yeah. So that's one. Yeah. It burns a little bit when it first goes in, but I mean, that's a really great option. And
is that available for purchase?
Yeah. It's all legal. You can totally purchase it. I'll link to his website. We might even have a discount code or something somewhere. I'll hunt it down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did a great podcast with him. Super smart formulator. He does both the suppositories, like the melatonin and the CBD suppositories, and then the Zen spray and the Zen essential oil spray. So that'd be another option. Another one that I'll do a lot of times in the later afternoon or the evening to get an increase in alertness as a mild stimulant without disrupting sleep and arguably actually enhancing deep sleep cycles based on some research on REM sleep is lion's mane. You know, and lion's mane has trace amounts of caffeine in it, but not enough to really keep you awake at night. And studies on lion's mane have shown that it can increase REM sleep. And so, you know, that's great because we know it can improve focus, improve neuroplasticity, increase levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and even balance out the HPA axis a little bit, almost like an adaptogenic herb would, but it's not disruptive to sleep, yet can make you alert. And I know some people who swear by it for improving their dreams, like lucid dreaming and things like that. So lion's mane would be another. I know some people in the plant medicine sector will even take lion's mane right before bed, along with a small dose of psilocybin for enhanced dream cycles. And that doesn't work for me. I find psilocybin to be too stimulative for me. Even a microdose will just make me super creative and I'll lay in bed thinking of amazing ideas. But lion's mane would be one that I think would definitely fit as an evening supplement. That's another one that I'm fine using at night. Doesn't keep me awake at all. Another one is L-theanine, and L-theanine is just fantastic. You know, it's an amino acid. You'll find it in green tea, like caffeine. It's got two components in it, theophylline and theobromine, that can enter the brain by crossing the blood-brain barrier. But when it does so, it increases the formation of alpha brainwaves, so it gives you this alert relaxation. And affects GABA and dopamine pathways a little bit in a way that increases attention and brain function. But not only does it not keep you up at night, but if you combine it with a stimulant such as caffeine, it can actually make caffeine a little bit less stimulative, right? And so it's one of those you can have in your back pocket, you know, if you happen to have made the mistake of having too much coffee. But it's also something that you can take by itself, around 100 milligrams or so, I find to be the sweet spot. You could take it with lion's mane. You could stack it with anything I've just described. And that's another one that can be a stimulant you can use at night that's not going to deleteriously impact your sleep cycles. So so that's one. And then there's one more that I'm fine with taking a smaller dose of at night. And it's a nootropic formula. It's made by a company called Neurohacker Collective. It's called Qualia Mind. And it's like a whole shotgun for me. It's got like huperzine, so you know, for learning and memory. It's got a Solastris, which enhances memory and learning. It's got like artichoke heart, you know, ginkgo biloba, but they make a caffeine free version of it. And even though if I'm going to crush a day of work and I want to take a nootropic formulation, I'll actually take anywhere from 6 to 8 capsules of it in the morning. And the reason I like the caffeine free in the morning is because I still do like to have a cup of coffee a lot of times in the morning. I don't want to double up on my caffeine. But then I've found in the evening, you know, if I just need a little pick me up, I'll take a half dose, like 3 or 4. Never seems to impact my sleep at all. And that one already has, you know, if you take 3 or 4, it's already got about 100 milligrams of theanine in it. So you're already getting some theanine too. And that's another kind of done for you formula that I find about a half dose of gives me good mental function in the evening. And, you know, I'm talking about the caffeine free version, doesn't seem to impair sleep cycles at all. So that'd be another one to throw into the mix.
I think it's got lion's mane in it as well. I'm not positive on that one. I think it does. I know it's got L-theanine, but yeah, I love that as well. You know, one other thing I would add too, to give a try, I actually texted you this morning about this because I've recently been using it, is I actually have been using like a teaspoon of the Bee Powered by the Beekeepers Naturals brand, which is kind of a mixture of honey, propolis, royal jelly, and bee pollen. And it is a great just like cognitive pick-me-up that I can utilize without any negative side effects. I mean, it's only got like 5 grams of sugar in it. So for, you know, a teaspoon of honey isn't awful.
Yeah, and that one's got a lot of like acetylcholine precursors in it, doesn't it?
Yep, it does. Yeah, it's phenomenal. So I would recommend that as well, especially, you know, if you take it right before class. I think kind of the amount of mental acuity you'll receive from that. And if you like stack that on top of like, you know, a small dose of Qualia Mind, caffeine-free, I think you're in for a good night of learning there, Steve.
Awesome. So there's your drug bag, Steve. Well, that's great. Hopefully we came up with some new tips for people. You know, this was kind of fun because hopefully people have gotten some ideas for enhancing their cold thermogenesis, enhancing their gym time with the blood flow restriction training, enhancing their evening activities with non-sleep disrupting stimulants, and staying the hell away from Subway. So we'll link to all this stuff at bengreenfieldfitness.com/420, along with the brand new Keon fish oil and some of our other fantastic sponsors like Juve and Clear Light. And who was the other sponsor we had today?
It was Viore.
And Viore clothing. So all at bengreenfieldfitness.com/420. And we'll also give away some swag. Should we give away some swag?
Oh, we got someone to give some swag to. Right,
let's do it. This is the part of the show where we will read a review. And if you leave us a review on any podcast platform that you listen in on and say something nice and you hear your review read on the show, that means we're going to send you a sweet-ass gear pack with a BGF t-shirt and beanie and BPA-free water bottle. And all you got to do is email gear@bengreenfieldfitness.com with your t-shirt size if you hear your review read. So that being said, take it away, Jay.
All right. So we've got a review from Kim12345. She says, or maybe him, "My health, energy, and outlook has all increased because of this podcast. It is so fun to try new things to increase all these fundamentally important facets of life. The how-to, as well as the science that backs up the info in the podcast, is what I needed to buy into this life-enhancing info. Thank you, Ben and team." And thank you, Kim.
Oh, awesome. Well, Kim, right gear at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Let us know your t-shirt size. We just sweet gear pack sent your way. In the meantime, for the rest of you listening in, bengreenfieldfitness.com/420. Woohoo! Is where you'll find all the show notes for your 420 enjoyment. And Jay, that was fun. Thanks, man.
Hey, it was a blast, man.
All right. Catch y'all on the flip side.
See ya.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at bengreenfieldfitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.